Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The impact of the arrival of the Charlotte Hornets in 1988 cannot be overstated. Their arrival was a sign that the city itself had arrived. We proved one sports columnist wrong, that the only franchise this city would ever have would be a McDonald's. No, we now had the NBA in a state that loves basketball. Those early years were magic for the team and the city. The Hornets played to sold-out crowds at the new Old Coliseum, or the old new Coliseum, on Tivola Road. And the players on that first roster became household names, big stars in this region. Kelly Trepiuka, Kurt Rambis, Dave Hoppin, Rex Chapman, Ricky Green, and Del Curry. Curry would play with the Hornets for a decade. His contributions were defined by elite shooting and remarkable consistency. He retired as the Hornets' all-time leader in points, 9,839, if I have that number right, and in the number of three-pointers made, 929. He became the first and only player on the team to win the NBA's Sixth Man of the Year award. In all, he played 701 games for Charlotte, which to this day is still the most for any player in team history. And of course, his association with the team has continued as the color analyst on the Hornets TV broadcasts. For that longtime association with Charlotte's first major league sports franchise and his contributions to it, Del Curry's number 30 jersey will be retired by the team, making him only the second player in franchise history to receive that honor. But before that happens, we're going to spend the hour with the man, the legend, the father of two other basketball greats, Del Curry. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
I know you by extension because I used to work with Steve Martin 100 years ago. We did mornings on another radio station, and now you're working with him on television.
I started working with Steve. Yeah, he broke me in.
He broke me in too. And many days he broke me. So what's it like being a legend, a basketball legend?
It's hard for me to consider myself that. I'm just a normal guy trying to live a normal life. I grew up playing basketball as a young kid. I was pretty good at it. Continued on with it. And just it's taken me places that I had no idea that I could go or do. It's been a really big part of my life, still is. So that word legend is hard for me to accept for myself, but I see it. I see it outside of that.
There are a couple of careers that require you to start when you're really young, mm-hmm. to be really good by the end of your career, or even in the middle of your career. Athletics is one of them. Dance is another, perhaps being a musician is the third. But you have to maintain the passion for what you started out as a kid loving to do. How do you do that?
Actually, my passion early was baseball. My father played in the semi-pro Negro League, and he was the catcher. My uncle was the pitcher, and they taught me how to play baseball at a very young age. So that was my passion. I was really good at baseball, played college baseball, was drafted out of high school and in college as well. And that's where I thought, I had an opportunity to get to the professional level. Was introduced to basketball through my high school coach, who also ran the rec league in the small town. Fell in love with it, but still baseball was my first love. But as I got to high school, played both, and then basketball just started to come to the forefront. I had the ability to shoot right away and just loved being in the gym by myself.
I was going to talk about baseball later, but since you skipped to the end, let's skip to the end. Let's talk about baseball because you were an accomplished player in high school, a pitcher, standout baseball and basketball player, and baseball's Texas Rangers drafted you, I believe this is correct, out of high school in 1982. And then again in 1985, you stayed in high school. We'll talk about that. But in 1985, the Baltimore Orioles wanted you based on your performance in college. Both these teams thought you had genuine pitching potential. you clearly have a facility for ball handling, whether it's a big ball like a basketball or a small ball like a baseball. What's that all about?
You know, when I was born, I'm one of five. I have four older sisters, and my dad told me, he often would tell me, "Boy, you're lucky to be here. I gave it one more try after having four daughters." But he said when I was born, the doctor looked at him and said, "Wow, this guy, your kid has some big hands. He's going to be an athlete." So I guess God-given ability right there from the jump of just being able to have that hand-eye coordination, big hands, big feet. My dad was a big guy, 6'3", 250. My mom was this 5'9". So it just ran the family.
To be in high school and get an offer to play professional baseball seems to be like a dream come true for most young men, because everybody wants to be a professional athlete.
Yeah.
How did you turn that down? How did you walk away from that opportunity?
My parents were very involved, obviously, in my childhood, and I watched them get up every morning, go to work together at General Electric, come back every day, put food on the table. We didn't have a lot, but I didn't know it. So I whatever they said, that was the Bible to me. I was going to do that. And at the time, I had an opportunity to go to college. My dad finished high school, dropped out of ninth grade. My mom finished. And I had an opportunity to go to college, get an education, and they very much wanted me to do that. But it was also on the assumption that wherever I went to college, I would play baseball. So that was a big thing to me. Okay, I'm not giving up baseball, but I could play it wherever I went to college. And all the colleges were like, "Yeah, we know you're a good baseball player. Basketball's your main sport. We'll allow you to play college." So that made the choice a little easier.
I read, I don't know whether this is true or not, but I read that when the Orioles came to you while you were in college,
yes,
and you had the opportunity to leave college and go to the Orioles, your father said, "What the hell is wrong with you? You ain't going nowhere. You're staying in college and you're playing basketball."
Correct.
Here's a guy who played baseball.
Correct, yeah, yeah.
Is that just about staying in school? What's that about?
It's about staying in school, about finishing what I started and getting my degree. And, you know, baseball, you have to go through rookie league, single A, double A, the whole deal. You have to progress and get better. And at that point, I knew I'd be a first-round draft pick in the NBA. And you're drafted in the first round, yeah, of the NBA, you're going to be right there with the big boys.
Plus, this is the kind of things that I think about, because I would rather be in a studio. I don't want to be the guy out in the field. It's hot. It's cold. You're standing in the snow. You're standing in the rain. You're standing in the blazing sun. That's baseball. Basketball, you're inside. Isn't there something to be said for that?
Well, I see where you're coming from. Baseball, I played shortstop or pitcher, so I was always involved in the action. But I'm from the country. I love being outside. I was a fisherman. I did everything outside. My father took me with him everywhere he went to get me out of the house and away from the four girls. So it was easy for me to be outside all day long.
So there are only a couple of players, there are a minority of players who get to have their jersey number retired and have their jersey hoisted into the rafters, and there's only one Hornet so far. You're the second for this to happen to. Talk to me about what this means to you personally.
You know, when the Hornets introduced this to me, that I was going to be have my jersey retired, which was an event in itself. I had no idea it was happening. And again, I try to be a humble guy with a confident, humble guy. So how I try to teach my kids. I've always thought, wow, do I really deserve this? And after it was announced that my jersey was going to be retired, so many people reached out and went, "Wow, you deserve it. It's about time. What took so long?" And started to think, you know what, maybe I do deserve this. And as I've traveled around to arenas now, I notice whose jerseys are retired, and I'll go, wow, okay, I do deserve this. But being the humble guy I am, it's still a blessing. You know, Rick, Gabe, Jeff Peterson, Shelley, the entire Hornets organization, Coach Lee, they didn't have to do this. But I feel blessed. I'm honored, grateful. and just can't wait for that day to come.
We're going to talk about the Hornets that first year. It was absolutely magic, that first year. We're going to talk about the early years of the Hornets, but you've been with the Hornets for 25 years now, and the atmosphere is different. The whole thing is different because, you know, it's not new.
Yeah.
And you're not the first team. You're not the only team anymore. We have all these other teams vying for people's attention. Are you glad you played in that first year as opposed to being on the team as a young person today?
Yes, absolutely.
Because they're winning today.
They're winning today, yeah. We lost our first game by 40 points and left to a standing ovation. You know, we were the only show in town. The fans were tremendous at the Charlotte Coliseum. We as young players, we had young and old. You mentioned Kelly Tripucka, Kurt Rambis, some of the older guys, and myself, Muggsy. We were young, first, second, third year in the league. It was my third team my third year in the league, and I was like, wow, I need to figure out how to make this a career, how to stick in the league. So we had a good group of guys, young and old, the young learning how to play the game, learning how to be professionals, the old trying to hang on as long as they could. But playing back in those days, having the support of the fans when we didn't win a lot of games, that really made it special.
And I would think was it harder on the younger, less experienced, just out of college players that we had on the team? Because you lost a lot in that first year. And college players get to the NBA because they win. And NBA players who have to play night after night after night after night for months on end understand that you have to move on from that loss and play the next game. Was it more difficult for the younger players to deal with that?
Absolutely. You said the younger guys, you get to the NBA because you win. You stay in the NBA because you win. You stay with the team because you win. If you don't, they're going to, you know, move on, try to find different players, better players. So, yeah, it was difficult, but we had a great group of guys in the locker room, and a lot of people don't see how important that is. The chemistry in the locker room, you have to get along with these guys. You have to have kind of the same agenda. There's so many different guys from different backgrounds. You can have so many different agendas in professional sports, but that was one thing that we always had. We had a strong locker room of leaders and the young guys, and we – didn't win a lot, but we had fun playing the game and playing with each other.
You've actually played for five NBA teams over the course of your career, the Utah Jazz in 86, the Cleveland Cavaliers in 87, and following the Hornets, you spent a year with the Bucks in Milwaukee, and then three seasons with the Toronto Raptors between 99 and 2002. You came to Charlotte in 1988 when you were selected in the expansion draft. You were the second pick overall and the Hornets' first pick. It's nice to be first, but I have to ask, did you want it? I mean, you were with the Cavaliers. You're coming to Charlotte where? What? Where's that? What's a Hornet? Did you want it?
I did.
Why?
I did. It was closer to home, so family and friends could come to watch me play. But they need to call first, so it was close enough, but it's farther enough away. And I played in Cleveland, some really young guys, and I thought coming here to Charlotte, I'm going to get playing time. I'm going to get an opportunity to actually make a career out of it, grow with a new team. And being from the South, I knew a little bit about Charlotte, so I was very excited to be here.
I want to talk about the other guys, too, because I'm wondering about them, particularly the guys who had more playing experience than you did because you were in your second career. And to come, first of all, to be traded, to me, would be a nightmare, just to be traded, period. I don't care where I am or where I'm going to, but to trade it to an expansion team might be something that might have given me pause if I had 4, 5, or 6 years in the league. But we have to take a break. We'll come back with Del Curry, Charlotte's Hornet player number 30, whose jersey is about to be retired. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Del Curry, member of the very first Charlotte Hornets team in 1988. We're going to talk about that magic season in a moment. His jersey is about to be retired. What's the date on that?
March 19th.
March 19th, which is a great honor for Dell and for any player who has that opportunity. But we were talking just before the break about whether or not it was an honor to be part of the expansion team at the Charlotte Hornets in 1988. Some of these guys had maybe a little more experience than you did, and you were already playing for an established team. What's that like to be traded as a player? That would be, I think, hard to deal with. I don't care who you are or where you are or how long you've been there.
Mike, I've never been traded. I've been drafted twice. Okay. I was drafted to Utah.
Okay.
I take that back. I was traded after my rookie year. But it was in the off season. To be traded in the off season, you have time to get wrap your head around it, make the moves. If you have a family, get everybody on the same page. But in season, it's so much different. It happens so fast. You have to get adjusted to your new teammates, your new city, your new coaches, your new environment. Everything is so new, and it comes at you so fast you really don't have time to think about what you're doing. So it's part of the game, part of the profession, but these guys are human. You're asked of it to move cities, move teams. It's an experience that you have to go through, and everybody reacts to it differently.
The first Hornets game, if I'm not mistaken, it was November the 4th, 1988. When did you arrive? When did the team, when did the players, the coaches, the staff assemble and have your first practice? How long did it take you to gear up for that first game?
I think we had the expansion draft, and then we had the regular NBA draft, like a week later.
Mm-hmm.
And we all got together a week or so after that and had some practices to try to see what the team's going to look like, introduce ourselves to the new coaches, new players. And then you go back, you have the summer to work on your game, but you really didn't get back to practice until September, October. So it was, again, a new team. Everything was new. Much like being traded, we kind of hit the ground running trying to figure out how we're going to be as the best that we could be.
That first game was electric. It was.
Yes.
I was there because I was working at the time for the station that broadcast the Hornets, so I got a little perk. I think all of Charlotte was there. It sat 24,000 people, I think, which is bigger than the current arena. But you described the atmosphere. What was it like to be on the floor?
Now, I got hurt. I broke my wrist the very first practice. So
right.
I had a different experience than the players. I was able to really look around and really soak up what the crowd was like, experience it. The players had to be on the floor playing the game, obviously, and try to put their focus there. But I was able to do both. I was like, wow, is this what's going to be like for the 41 games? Because we were not very good at all. Like I said, we lost by 40, and every seat was occupied from the start to the very last horn. And it was like that most of the season.
And so you lost?
We lost.
Standing ovation.
Guys had tuxes on, women had gowns, and we walked off to a standing ovation by losing by 40 points to the team that I had just left, the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Yeah, talk to me about that, because you were playing, although you didn't play because you'd broken your wrist in practice, you were playing against your old team.
Yeah.
So I guess you had a chance to talk to guys that you knew. What was their reaction to what they experienced in that first game, even though they won?
Yeah, I'm still good friends with Brad Daugherty, Mark Price, Ron Harper. I was on that team, and I just saw Brad a couple of weeks ago. He does color analyst for the Cleveland Cavaliers. And Brad, playing from went to college in North Carolina, he knew how, basketball was, how exciting people were about basketball in North Carolina. He was like, wow, you're going to like it here. As soon as you guys start winning some games, you're going to love it here. Every team that came in knew, regardless of how good we were, they needed to be on their best because of the atmosphere, that if we made any kind of run or had anything happen on the floor, the fans were going to be behind us, and it was going to be a tough game for our opponents. So they knew that it was going to be a hostile environment when they played.
But I don't think anybody knew exactly how enthusiastic fans would be. It was remarkable. I mean, and even people who didn't go to the game, the idea that we had a profession, people have to understand, this is a different Charlotte than it is today.
Yeah.
The idea that we had a professional NBA team in our midst. We had arrived. It changed. It sounds silly today, but it had changed the nature of who Charlotte is, or what Charlotte is. The CH factor, Chicago, Charlotte, Charleston. That was the beginning of the end of that. You guys made it happen.
We understood how big it was, having an expansion team come to a new city. We understood the landscape and the fact that we were the first to do this, and we were trying to get it right, trying to do it as best we can, trying to set the foundation for what the team was to be. But it was so different. There were two buildings in Uptown, and we played out in Tavola, so we never went to Uptown. You only drove by Interstate 77, and you saw those two buildings.
Yeah.
So the landscape's totally changed.
That was in November, that first game. In December, you played the Chicago Bulls. You beat Michael Jordan's Chicago Bulls. You beat them 103-101 at home on national television. And they say that the sound – I wasn't there for that, but they say the sound from the fans was indescribable at the end of that game. Is that accurate?
Very accurate. Very accurate. Now, think about how exciting – we've talked about how the first game, every game in the Coliseum, first year expansion team, tough ticket to get. When you got that ticket, you didn't give it away.
Right.
And now you bring in the Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan. So that all that excitement gets amplified just by the fact that it's the Bulls and Michael Jordan. And then we beat them. I think it was on the last tip-in shot by Kurt Rambis. So, yeah, multiply the excitement of a regular game by 100 when you play a Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls team.
Old-timers say that was the beginning of Hornets hysteria. Everybody was excited that you were here. Everybody was excited for that first game. But when you beat the Chicago Bulls, that was the beginning of this. Everybody was in on the thing now.
We've arrived. We've beaten the best team in the NBA. We know what we're doing. We got it figured out.
Let's go back to that first practice, because you broke your wrist at the first practice at the Grady Cole Center. This is before we had facilities for the Hornets. You were slumming it.
Yeah, we were. Yes.
But you broke your wrist at the first practice. I mean, what went through your mind? You knew you were out for a couple of games at that point.
I was out for 6 weeks. I had 6 weeks in a cast. I'm like, what? My navicular bone. I'll never forget it. It was Dr. Perry. He goes, you broke your navicular bone. I'm like, what? I'm like, it's a little numb. He goes, yeah, it's the smallest bone in your wrist. No blood flow. We got to cast you up. I remember very first practice, we're having a scrimmage. I go down the lane. I shoot a runner, and Kenny Fields pushes me in the chest. Mm. Call a foul. Try to break my fall. Come down on my wrist. I'm like, wow, that hurt. Broke my wrist. Right away, 6 weeks out, and I was expected to be a starter. So there goes the starting job. I got to work my way back. I got to stay in shape. I'm like, wow, is this really happening right now? So just had to fight through it as an athlete. You're gonna have injuries. You're gonna have ups and downs. And it was my first real injury as an NBA player. I really hadn't been injured at all as a athlete. So it was a difficult time, again, having something that you love doing and in a new place, think you're going to have a new career, gets off to a bad start.
Not good. When you join any team, you have to find a way to fit in, not just on the court, not just in what you do for the team on the court, but as a person, as a human being. And now you have this expansion team where nobody knows anybody. Everybody's coming in on day one, new. They have no chemistry. They have no personal relationships in many cases, although maybe some of them played together elsewhere or played against each other elsewhere. And then you have a coach that nobody really knows. How do you form? At what point? How long does it take to become cohesive, to be a team as opposed to individuals?
I think that depends on each individual team, each individual player. That's why you get together as early as you can in the off season to kind of form that chemistry, that bond. I'd known Muggsy in high school or in college. I talked to him a little bit. Ricky Green was on that team. I played with him in Utah. I followed the NBA before I got there, so I knew obviously Kurt Rambis coming from the Lakers, Kelly Chipuka, All-Star coming from Detroit. So you knew a couple of guys, and a lot of guys I'd played against in college. But again, you get them in the locker room, you don't know who that person is until you're around them at all times, and you are around them during an NBA season. You're around those players more than your family, so you really get to know that person quickly. We had a real tough coach in Dick Harter, Army background, tough guy. We'd often say, Dick, you know we're an expansion team. We're not going to win 40 games. Take it easy. But he was a hard-nosed guy.
Yeah, I heard that he used to tear you apart at halftime.
Oh my gosh. Everybody. But Kelly, he loved Kelly Chipuka. Kelly was the only one that had a free pass.
That must have
ticked all of us off, yeah.
You could do no wrong in that first season. I mean, I think, what did you win, 20 games?
10, I think. Okay. 10.
But you could do no wrong.
No,
the fans didn't care.
It was a free pass.
They didn't care.
Yeah, right.
Just the fact that you existed was all that mattered. When did that change? Because you were a player for 10 years. When did that change?
I think when we started getting – you know, some really good draft picks, J.R. Reed, Lonzo Mourning, Larry Johnson, and myself, Muggsy. We were starting to develop chemistry, starting to develop a foundation. But it all changed, obviously, when you start sniffing the playoffs. You got a chance to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
So 2, 3, 4 years, you know, it takes that long, I think, to build a good chemistry foundation of players, and then it's time to start doing something.
Here's another thing that I remember about that time period, because everybody was excited we had a professional team, and this is basketball country. It had always been basketball country, particularly because of the ACC and because of Duke and because of UNC Chapel Hill. What doesn't happen in college basketball that does happen in pro basketball is that people get traded.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't used to that. And I remember public reaction when those trades began to happen, when some people's favorites disappeared from the roster and these new guys started coming in. That we weren't used to that. Even though you see it happening in other cities, we were now living it. Did it feel that way to the team, where you were already a professional athlete, so it didn't matter? I mean, it was nothing new to you.
No, but no player wants to be traded. That feeling is like, oh, they don't want me. Or you can have the feeling like, hey, somebody out there does want me, especially if you get traded to a better team. So it depends on your mindset of how you feel about a trade. But I was the one guy who was in trade talks every single year I played with the Hornets, every year. It was so bad at one point, probably my eighth or ninth year with the team, I got a call from the GM. We flew from Charlotte to Minnesota. We had a game. And on trade deadline was just about over. Maybe we had 30 minutes left. I get to the hotel. My phone rings. We didn't have cell phones. My hotel phone rings. I'm like, oh, they wait until I got here. The GM was calling me to tell me I didn't get traded. That's how rumored I was in every trade. So it happens. We had a lot of veterans on that first team that had been traded before, so they could kind of tell us what it was like. But again, until you go through it as an individual, it's different.
So they talk to you every year, and yet you were the last standing original Hornet on the team. Mm-hmm. You were the last original Hornet to play on the Charlotte Hornets team. How did you survive?
I was the first guy on the expansion team, the last player to leave from that expansion team. How did I last so long? Because I could shoot the basketball. The coach, you doesn't matter what kind of team you have. Coaches need guys that can shoot the ball and put it in the hole, and that was the best thing I did in the NBA.
We have a lot of people who have moved here from elsewhere in recent years, and they were not here in 1988. Some of our listeners weren't born in 1988. That first year was magic for a number of reasons. First of all, We were never expected to get this expansion team. Never. It was never going to happen. Charlotte was a very different place. We got it. George Shinn, I think Rick Hendrick played a role. Felix Sabatas played a role. Carl Shear played a major
role.
Cy Bayhackle, yeah. who owned Channel 18, played a role in all of this. And we got this team, and they threw George Shinn a parade before the team played its first game, before the team arrived. And then after the season was over, a losing season, a really losing season, they gave the team a ticker tape parade. And I cannot stress, I don't know why I feel this way, but I cannot stress enough how magic this whole thing was. You had uniforms by Alexander Julian.
Yeah.
That was a big deal for everybody. So when you look back on that time, when you were all golden, didn't matter what you did, are you glad you went through it? Because this is something most people never experience.
Absolutely. We thought that the uniforms were a little over the top with the pleats. We thought the parade
Baggy.
Was ridiculous. We're like, do we really have to go and be a part of this parade? But we understood it was about the fans. They wanted to celebrate the team, not the success, not the wins, but just show the appreciation of us showing up every night, playing the best that we can, giving it all. They wanted to celebrate us. So, yeah, it was okay.
I saw this short video. I guess it was a celebration of something, and one of the guys on the video was somebody in the front office in that first year of the Hornets, and he was in the parade. And he said, you know, the one thing I take away from this is that I would never have been in a parade in my entire life, and I felt silly being in the parade because who was I? It was about the athletes. I'm a guy who pushes pencils in the front office, but I'm in the parade, and I had a good time. That's the kind of
thing. Much like the Hornets today, I think you have coaches, players, front office. It's a family. Everybody has to play their role, and everybody has to depend on the person beside them in order for the franchise to succeed. We were a new franchise, small franchise, but I think that's the one thing everybody understood. In order for that person to do their job well, it took the person on their right to do his job well. So it's a family. Everybody depends on the other person, and that's why you want to do your best, because you know you have people depending on you.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about you. I want to talk about the basketball dynasty that you have created over your lifetime, and several other things in preparation for Del Curry's number 30 jersey to be retired by the Hornets on March 19th. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Del Curry is our guest. His jersey is being retired on March the 19th by the Charlotte Hornets, which is a real honor. And why not? Because it is said that your presence on the Hornets when you arrived gave the team credibility, because you're shooting stretch defenses in an era before, and this goes back to high school, in an era before the three-point line existed, you were shooting three-pointers.
Yes.
So you became the emotional, I'm told, and statistical backbone of the Hornets in that first decade. As an analyst, you know the importance of stats and how teams follow the stats and how players follow the stats. Do they follow the stats the same way that you as an analyst would, or that the owners and the managers and the coaches follow the stats? Are the players aware day-to-day, night-to-night, of what their participation has meant?
Absolutely. That's part of your job. I think you have to be aware of your stats, and you have to compare them to other players around the league to see how you're doing. Especially with analytics today, we didn't have that back when I played, but the numbers are so important for the success of the team. Depends on, you know, how important the coaches in the organization feel about analytics, because you can change the numbers around and make them, you know, say whatever they want to say, but players absolutely should know their stats, and they should compare them to the other players of their position around the league. That's part of being a competitor, part of wanting to improve as a player, to know what the other guy's doing and try to get better at your job.
It is said by many people that you essentially changed the game because of your three-point abilities and the fact that they had to cover you even if you didn't have the ball. Mm-hmm. Because wherever you were on the court, you might be a dangerous guy. Did you know that about yourself while it was happening? Did you think, I'm changing this game? I'm playing it differently than has been played in the past.
I don't know about changing the game. I knew that I was a deadly shooter and people had to guard me, and that helped my teammates play better. It gave them more space to move around and drive the ball and do certain things. So I knew I was very important to the team, and especially as a sixth man. Every professional player wants to start. Everybody thinks they're good enough to start, but every team needs guys that can come off the bench, play their role, be happy with it, and know that they're just as important as the starters. And I was that guy. I knew I had a role with this team, and that was coming off the bench, changing the game. It gave me a chance to watch the game to see, you know, how the game had started, how I could come in and put my imprint on it and change it and help the team. And I took that I was very prideful in that, wanting to come in and play my role every single night, being the best that I can off the bench.
You were kind of the prototype for the way the game is played today. I mean, is that because of you? Because of the way you were able to do what you did, now it's done. Every team has to do that now.
Yeah. I'm a 40% career three-point shooter, and I took maybe four or five a game. We have guys that take four or five a quarter now. That's how much the three-point shot has changed the game and how important it is. And if you have a team that cannot make threes, you're not going to be successful in today's NBA. It's just point blank. You have to have guys that can shoot the ball. And coaches would love it if all five players from each position could make threes. And if you don't have that guy, you have to, you know, change your offense or your strategy around that. And then defending a five-man that can shoot a three, that changes the game as well. So the three-point shot has really changed the game. It's an integral part, and it's not going anywhere. It's here to stay.
Clearly, you have professional athletics in your genes. Your father was a player. Your sons are players. You've created this dynasty of Currys in basketball. And these are two young guys, Steph and Seth, who grew up watching their father play, grew up in locker rooms, grew up watching other players, grew up understanding what it takes to be a professional athlete, understanding the non-playing side of the game, and the mental facility that it takes to be in the game all the time. Did they ask you questions about this growing up? Did you guide them growing up? Did you push them toward basketball growing up? Did you dissuade them from a professional athletic career? Talk about that.
Yeah, they were constantly asking me questions. Did not push them, didn't have to. They love the game of basketball. I think I was a very fortunate dad. My boys wanted to do whatever their dad was doing. They wanted to go with me everywhere. And so it was easy to introduce them to the game. I introduced them to all sports, football, basketball, baseball, soccer. And I was like, you're going to make up your mind of what sport you want to concentrate on. And they gravitated toward basketball easily. They both played a little golf, baseball, but basketball was their main sport.
Did you coach them along the way?
I coached them. That's one part of being a professional basketball player. You have mm-hmm. summers off. So I coached them in every sport. Obviously, baseball. I really like coaching them in baseball. Coached them in AAU basketball as well. But at one point, probably when they were, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, I'm like, okay, I need to pull back. They've heard my voice enough. Mm. I need to hand them off to someone just for a different voice. I was still there coaching in my own way, but not their everyday voice.
Can you keep up with them on the garage hoop?
I can for about a game or two. I don't have the stamina or the endurance that I did, but I can still. I always joke that if you can shoot the basketball, that's the last thing, that's the last skill to leave you, and that skill is far from leaving me. I can still shoot the basketball. So we have good games in the summer. They're just not as long as they used to be.
Do you see yourself in the way they play? In other words, when you look at them and you see them playing in a game, do you see things that you used to do, or you see them do things the way you do it?
Absolutely, especially the way they move when they don't have the ball, coming off of screens, making the right cut, reading the ball and where the ball is going. They're high basketball IQ players, and I think that's because they were introduced to the game very young, at a young age. They used to come to practice, watch the games, and they watched their dad. They watched other players that I played against. They watched to see what was happening. And like you said, being in the locker room, being around professional athletes at a young age really helped them be the players they are.
How important is that? And how, in other words, and there are a lot of people who come to this sport with a lot of talent and skill and ability. But your kids come to it with all of that, plus they lived it with you. They saw it up close with you and the other members of the team, and they traveled with you. They lived it. How important is that? Is that part of why Steph is so friggin' good?
I would say yes. It definitely is, but it has to be a controlled environment. I say this jokingly, but I think the NBA, the lifestyle, it's a fantasy lifestyle. It's not a normal lifestyle. So I kind of helped shield my boys as much as I could from that lifestyle. I made sure they knew dad's going to work. It's a job. It's what I do for a living. It's how I support my family. But you still have to work at it. The games are the easy part. What people don't see, the practice, the sacrifice, the summertime work, the time you're in the gym when no one's watching, that's what makes the professional player who he is. And I wanted to make sure my sons understood that.
I think it's like that in almost every performance profession. The performance is the fun part.
Correct.
Playing is the fun part, but there's all the stuff that comes before that nobody sees that is hard and difficult and exhausting.
Yeah. And my boys are ready for that. I coached them hard. I pushed them when they decided that this is what I want to do. This is how you got to go about it. If you want to be an NBA player, this is what you have to sacrifice. You can't go out with your buddies all the time. You got to make sure that you're doing what you have to do to reach the goal that you want. They understood that at a young age, mm-hmm. and they still understand that.
Athletes are competitors by their very nature. They have to be successful, and yet you have two sons who are playing on the same team, the Golden State Warriors. They can't get away from each other. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem for them?
No, not at this point. they're veterans in the league. Steph's is his 17th year, Seth's 11th, 12th. They're getting up there in age. They haven't played together yet. They're on the same team, but they have yet to play a game together because of injury. Again, that happens as well. But they're enjoying their time, especially at this point of their careers, to be able to play together as brothers. They haven't played together since high school. They haven't been on the same team as high school. So early in the year, Seth was with the Warriors. It wasn't a good time for him. He was much like me when I was young, trying to find his way in the league. He went through the G League, trying to make a career. He wanted to get out from under the shadow of his brother, create his own career, his own niche, and he did that. So now's the perfect time for them to be back together.
You're one of those guys who has transitioned from being on the court and being a professional athlete to being somebody who brings these games to those of us who watch them. You're a color analyst on television, and you athletes are taking our jobs. I just want you to know that. You're all becoming broadcasters. But that didn't happen for a while. I think you retired in 2002.
Correct.
Became a color analyst in 2009. What did you do for those 7 years?
First 2 years, the Hornets weren't here. I became a scratch golfer.
Right.
Coached my boys in high school. And then the Bobcats came. I knew the president, who used to work in my agent's office, said, "Hey, I'm in town. I want to be a part of it." He's like, "Absolutely." So I was actually an ambassador before we had any players for the Bobcats then. So I've been with the organization since then. I've done several roles. I was a coach for a summer, a scout, player development. I've done everything. And I realized, the 9-to-5 job going to the office isn't for me. And I was ready to do something else.
Yeah.
And they said, how about color analysts? I'd done a couple of college games, enjoyed talking about the game. Did a couple of college games. They go, you want to try to be a color analyst? I'm like, yeah, I'll try that. So the guy who was doing it, Henry Williams, who passed, he was leaving to be a full-time pastor. They put the job out there. A couple of us did some games. They said, you want to do it? I said, absolutely. And this is, I absolutely love.
What's it take to be a good color analyst?
You have to love the game, which I still do. I love, you have to watch the game. You have to love watching the game. I still do. I watch games every single night. You have to understand what's going on out there, and you have to make it. My job, I think, is to try to bring it to the fans in a way that your average fan would understand what's happening, why it's happening, and how it's happening.
Your son, Seth, played for the Hornets for two seasons.
Yes.
And he wore your number 30 jersey for two seasons. You're a proud papa, no doubt. And you had to be the color commentator on television for those games. You have to be professional. Was it difficult?
It was not difficult then. When Stephen got into the league, it was a little difficult at first because I'm calling the game. I'm watching my son, and I go, wait a minute. I got to watch the other nine guys out there
as
well. But I always had the mindset that their grandmother, my mother, is watching the game. And I have to say, she's going to let me know if I say something that's not appropriate about her grandchildren. So I kind of think about that with all the players out there. I'm like, their families are watching the game. It's a basketball game. People are going to make mistakes. It's not going to be perfect. Let's have some fun. Let's celebrate the game, celebrate the players, regardless of whether they play for the Hornets or the other team. They're athletes. They're just normal people playing a game they love. So I kind of celebrate the game.
How do you keep your focus? I mean, it's natural to focus on somebody that you've lived with their whole lives. And you got these other guys on the court, but your eyes, I would think your brain is forcing your eyes
to
go.
It's a knack. I've learned to watch my son while also watching the other nine guys. But I love this is what I love to do. I love to travel. I love being around the coaches, the players, and I love watching the game. I love watching the strategy of how each team is playing the opposing team, how the Hornets' strategy changed from game to game, the players' growth, the players' development, and I like being around the guys to try to give them, you know, ins and outs of what my career was like and how I think I can help their careers.
The Hornets have been recently on this winning streak. I think when we recorded this conversation, which was, I'm not sure when it's going to air, but it's within a couple of weeks. It's one of the hottest teams in the NBA.
We'll still be hot when this airs, Mike.
How do you know that? but they've transformed from this struggling team into a possible playoff contender. To what do you attribute that?
Front office, owners, coaching. The entire building has changed. The culture of the building has changed. I think the quality of people that are in the locker room now, starting with this draft, we have a great group of rookies. The guys that were in the locker room, the best thing could have happened is they get a year experience and they know what the NBA is all about, how they need to conduct themselves. But it's a family. It's a full team ownership from the front office to the ownership to the coaches to the PR. Everybody has to have the buy-in, be on the same page. And then you have to play for the person on either side of you.
Speaking of family, I'll have less than a minute left. They're going to haul your jersey, number 30, up into the rafters on March the 19th. They're retiring that jersey. And you told the Charlotte Observer that you couldn't quite put into words the way you feel about that. We've already talked about that a little bit, but they could have done this on December 31st when the Hornets played the Golden State Warriors, and your two sons would have been there. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be there?
Yes, they are.
They're
coming in. Yeah, the Warriors on an East Coast trip, and the 19th is in between games. So kids are going to be there, the grandkids, everybody's going to be there to celebrate. This is a big day. This is my boys being in the game understand how big this is. Seth being the last 30 to wear it, number 30, everybody's super excited, and I can't wait.
Del Curry, congratulations on a great career, and thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.